From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on January 13, 2015, when a 46-year-old attorney woke up at 5 a.m. feeling unusual. Sue Palmer was her name. She was in good health, physically fit, no history of problems. But she rushed to the bathroom to throw up. She figured she'd picked up a 24-hour bug. A few minutes later, she threw up again. Her husband said, "You ought to go see a doctor." And she said, "Look, I've got to be in bed all day. It's going to be one of those things." He said, "No, you really ought to go." And he convinced her to go. Well, within minutes, a team of doctors and staff were rushing her in for emergency treatment. She was afflicted with a condition that she heard described as the widowmaker. Here's what she wrote this week in the Washington Post. Maybe you saw her story. Quote, "My right coronary artery was 100% blocked, and the center artery, called the LAD, was 70% blocked. LAD blockage is the problem they call the widowmaker because it is the most frequent source of sudden death. It kills a lot of people, including soprano star James Gandolfini and newsman Tim Russert. Comedian Rosie O'Donnell survived hers, but doctors say it's a true serial killer," end quote. But Sue's life was saved that day. They caught the problem in time. For her, it was all the evidence she needed that heart disease or problems can afflict us at any age, sometimes without warning. The key is understanding how to deal with it. And this hour, we've got a conversation about heart disease and some personal stories that will help add some perspective. It's also a great chance for you to have questions answered, if you have them, about your heart health. I've got two doctors here who can help you with that. Dr. Timothy Malins is the Chief of Medicine at Geneva General Hospital and President of the New York Cardiological Society. Dr. Malins, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Evan.
Dr. Eugene Storozynski is here. He's an Associate Professor of Cardiology at UR Medicine, Director of the Cardio-Oncology Clinic at URMC, where he specializes in patients with cardiac complications of cancer and cancer therapy. And Dr. Storozynski, I'm sure we've got a lot to talk about. Thanks for taking the time to be here.
Thank you, Evan.
Jerry Serafine's here. Jerry is a heart attack survivor. You know him as the owner of Restaurant Tuvine, but Jerry, your heart attack was right before the holidays, is that right?
Yes, that's right, Evan.
And how you doing?
I'm doing great.
Well, thanks for being willing to share the story. We're going to get into that coming up. Madison Hoadley is here. Maddie is 16 years old. She's a junior at Spencerport High School, and she's a congenital heart disease survivor. She was born with critical aortic stenosis. Maddie, you're going to tell us all about that coming up here, but thank you. How are you doing?
I'm doing good.
Well, it's great to see you here. And her mother is Dawn Hoadley. And Dawn, welcome to the program as well. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you very much.
I guess I'll start with Dr. Malins. And this story in the Washington Post kind of stopped me in my tracks because it's one thing for a guy like me. I was born with a congenital heart condition, Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome. I had an ablation when I was 17. Had to call you a year ago about SVT. So I'm in that category of people who've dealt with this. But it's another to hear about a woman who's 46 years old and is fit and works out and wakes up one morning and it basically has minutes to figure out what's wrong before she could be gone. That's an amazing story. How often do you hear about LAD blockage?
Very common. I mean, it's something that we see often, and it is known as a widowmaker. It supplies a large area to the heart, and a significant blockage of that, if you knock off a big area of the heart, you're going to have sudden death, which is mostly arrhythmic, and can be a major heart attack. I think the interesting part of this story is, Dr. Storozynski will echo this, is that we see women have different symptoms, and a lot of times they will feel that I had a 24-hour bug, and it won't really trigger the alarm bells. At least in her story, the alarm bells were triggered, and she was treated. But imagine if she stayed there and didn't do anything for 24 hours, and we lost a lot of heart muscle or myocardium. The outcome could have been a lot worse.
Yeah, Dr. Storozynski, she writes about having no clue that it could even be a heart issue. It was her husband who had to push her to get that kind of a treatment. And thank goodness, because the clock is ticking there. What do you make of that story?
Well, I think what's interesting about her is that she had 100% blockage on the right side in the right coronary artery on her angiogram and a 70% blockage in the widowmaker, right, as was described. So it's hard for me to believe that she absolutely had no symptoms at all with that 100% blockage.
No, she said vomiting.
But the 100% blockage is something that's been happening over time, and it's a gradual thing. Most likely what happened is that it's the 70% blockage that gave her all the symptoms acutely, right, causing her to have the nausea, the vomiting. And probably what was happening is that she may have had what we call collateral insufficiency, meaning that because of the 100% blockage that she had in that right coronary artery, it caused her own blood vessels to start forming little tributaries. And probably when she developed that 70% blockage in the LAD, those tributaries were no longer able to provide the or receive the blood flow that they needed. And that is what caused her to have the symptoms. So with 100% blockage, someone should have symptoms have occurred. Either things like, you know, she's exercises regularly, but maybe her exercise limits are decreasing, right? Or maybe that she's getting more short of breath with less activity, but still just...
So somewhere there might have been a red flag you think
there
missed.
Most likely would have been a red flag okay. at some point if she was aware of the symptoms.
Can I ask both of the doctors on this panel the question that she kind of hinted at, which is that when you're in that situation, you know, you're nauseous, but you're feeling like, really, do I go to the hospital? Do I waste their time? They're so busy. I can give you a personal example of how you feel that way, even on a much smaller scale. I mean, my almost 5-year-old was throwing up and kind of had a fever, but we're not really hypochondriacs about him. We're going, do you really take him in overnight? And but his fever got up to about 105. We take him in. By the time we get there, he's 99, and he's telling the doctors, like, yeah, it's cool to be here. I want to be a doctor someday. And I'm going, oh, my gosh, we are just wasting your time. But part of her message in the story is, you know, don't feel like you're wasting their time. The worst they do is send you home. What would you say to that, doctor?
I agree. I mean, I think I think you can't be a hypochondriac. And I think in her case, she probably knew that this was more than just simple nausea and throwing up. Right. She was also getting dizzy and lightheaded. And so that changes the paradigm here. And I think that if her husband, as he looked at her and saw that she was probably cool and clammy, those are all signs potentially of there being something much more dangerous than a simple GI bug that
okay.
she has.
Dr. Malins, for anybody who feels like, you know, do I really go in? You know, is it worth the time? What's it going to cost? Is it worth it to the staff? What's the message here? What's the message, especially from Sue's story?
Well, I think part of what we see in Sue's story is, I mean, we can read it on paper, but as a physician, you don't know the intricacies of it. We don't know whether it was an acute blockage of that other artery or that. So we can take that at face value. I would say this. I mean, we should know the warning signs that we've all talked about. So the typical ones are chest pain, pressure, jaw pain, shortness of breath. If you have things like that, certainly you should seek help. On the contrary, we are, even outside of the cardiology, our medical system and our ER system is very burdened. So if it's sniffles or something like that, you know, you don't need, you know, maybe call your primary and see something like that. But if you have any of the warning signs that we've talked about for heart disease or acute heart attack, I would say that you're better safe than sorry. And to remember, especially with women, women have atypical symptoms. And this is a good case for it. Mm-hmm. If they feel something is wrong, I would seek help.
Listeners, if you've got questions about heart health, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Jerry's heart attack was just before the holidays, and give me some of the background on your story, kind of what led up to it, what happened with you.
It's so interesting that you're talking about symptoms that you don't recognize. You see someone having a heart attack on TV, and they're grabbing their chest, and they're writhing around, and someone magically appears with paddles, and it's not like that at all. I have no history of heart disease in my family, my parents, grandparents. It would be the last thing on my mind. I happened to be driving with my partner, and we were joking around about stuff, and she said, geez, I hope you don't have a heart attack before we finish this project that we were working on. And I started laughing. And I got home, and 10 minutes later, I started having what I thought was severe heartburn. But because that seed was planted in my head, it just kept going around, heart attack, heart attack. And if I wasn't even thinking about that, I would have gone and laid down on the couch and started eating Tums, because it feels like really bad heartburn. It feels like you have a gas bubble in your esophagus and you're trying to burp. But then the lightheadedness kicks in, and then you know this is not heart. This is not normal. Your arms are tingly.
How long did that take?
It took about 10 minutes.
That's it, yeah.
And I called my partner, and I said, I think you better come back over here. There's something wrong. And for some reason, she kind of knew what was going on. She sped over to my house, which don't do that. Call an ambulance. But I figured, you know, I didn't want this ambulance pulling up at my house. It'll be embarrassing.
All the smart things that usually men, but people think about, you know,
well,
health,
then
right?
Then she said, how embarrassing would it be with a hearse pulling up in front of your house?
So, that's a good rejoinder. Very good.
So we sped down Highland Avenue, and this was like a scene from a Larry David show. I'm like sort of writhing on the front seat, and she's all calm. Don't worry. We're almost there. We're almost there. Blowing through red lights. We pass this guy. He's yelling, you know, beeping the horn at us, and I'm looking out the window, pantomiming, I'm having a heart attack, with some choice words thrown in there.
Uh-huh.
And he gives me the middle finger. So she's laughing, I'm laughing, but in pain. Get to Highland, and again, if you don't come in an ambulance, I'm literally sitting in a chair going through the check-in process saying, do you understand what's going on here? And finally, a doctor came out and said, get back here, and nitroglycerin pill under the tongue. And the symptoms went away immediately. But this was 15 minutes after I felt these symptoms, and I think that was so important. And then I said, gee, I feel great. I'm going to go home. And he said, no, you're not going home. Spent the night under observation, blood tests, determined that there was a small event. And the next morning, I was at Strong getting a stent put in. And it was, you come out of there with a Band-Aid on your wrist and good to go.
How have you felt since?
Great. In fact, you almost feel a little bit better after because you have better circulation.
Wow.
But I went to they have a really great rehab program. You know, you're on the treadmill, you're hooked up. You're doing exercises, and you're hooked up so they can monitor you because you don't want to jump back in, and you don't want to go back to your gym and blow up on the treadmill. So that you go through a number of sessions with them, and then they give you the green light saying you're good.
All right. Any Hopefully. Limitations for you now?
No.
Wow.
None.
And there's no fatigue, anything like that?
No. Nothing. It's great. It's the miracle of modern medicine.
Modern medicine is amazing, isn't it?
When it works, as they say.
Yeah, that's really amazing. Well, Dr. Malins and Dr. Storozynski, want to evaluate that story? What are the lessons we can draw from that? Tim, what do you think?
You know, it's interesting with Jerry. He didn't have a lot of risk factors going in, and so it can certainly happen to anybody. But he did the right thing other than the driving through the area of Highland and passing cars, all of that. So there's additional danger to that. But, I mean, you know, one critique would be certainly if you feel it to call EMS, especially something of that. The take-home message that I take is from my standpoint with Jerry's story is he knew something was wrong. It wasn't your typical heartburn, and that's something that we hear all the time. I mean, there was, and I don't know if you felt this or not, but what's described to me a lot of times, the feeling of, quote, impending doom. And I don't know if you felt something, and that's the meaning that something is seriously wrong here.
That's what kicked in. All of a sudden, you're like, I've got heartburn. And then you go, no, something's really wrong. Something's really wrong. And I don't know if it's the lightheadedness, the dizziness, but you're feeling like you're just going to go crashing any minute.
And so you hear that kind of description, Dr. Malins. And so when you say it's not the typical heartburn, the problem is I don't know what the typical feeling of a heart attack is here. So, you know, maybe Jerry is convincing himself, well, this is heartburn, but it's just really bad heartburn. It's really severe. It sounds like it took an additional symptom, the lightheadedness, for you to go, wait a second.
Lightheadedness and your arms feel like they're floating all of a sudden. And then you sit there and say, this isn't right.
How common of a description are these from what you hear?
I mean, it's common. If you kind of take it as a whole, it's not surprising. I don't think it would be surprising to Eugene or myself. But, you know, your typical, as we talked about, that crushing chest pain, we see that a lot. If you think about the heartburn, and I like that description, because if you think about how it is and how our heart is actually innervated. So the similar, and heartburn is typically the esophagus, the same nerves really trigger or innervate the heart as well as the esophagus. So a lot of times it's very difficult to differentiate. And so if somebody gets heartburn all the time, they can say, you know, it's heartburn. But it's always there's something else for the most part, and things will get worse. And so if we had everybody showing up to the ER every time they had heartburn, it would be concerning. He had a heartburn before, and it was this time something clearly different.
Well, it's interesting, too. When I got to the hospital, the doctor said, you know, it could be your esophagus at this point. We don't know. And the nitroglycerin pill will also alleviate that because it's opening up all those blood vessels and relaxing everything. So they did an EKG, which at the time was normal. I literally said, I'm going to go home now. And they were, no, you're not.
Well, Dr. Storozynski, is that anything else you want to add to this diagnosis for Jerry? Sounds like he's doing great.
No, I mean, I think everything that's been said here, I would echo as well. But I think the other caveat or the other important thing is the constellation of symptoms that you had. It wasn't just the heartburn. It was everything else that came along with it, which was different. And then I think, as Dr. Malins had said, it's very important to also note that women often may present very differently from men, and that just because a woman doesn't have the substernal chest pain, the pain radiating down the left arm, or the jaw pain that we typically associate with a heart attack, those are frequently the symptoms with men, but women very often present differently. They may present with decreased exercise tolerance, unexplained exertional shortness of breath, and these could be the important warning signs.
All right, well, let's turn to a very different story, and I'll ask Dr. Malins to send that microphone over to Dawn so they each have one. So we've got Dawn Hoadley and her daughter Madison Hoadley, and Maddie is 16 years old. She's a junior at Spencerport High School. You were born with critical aortic stenosis, and Maddie, I'll ask you as long as I can. Mom can jump in whenever you need here, but what is critical aortic stenosis?
So for me, I've had two open heart surgeries. Yeah, I was born with aortic stenosis. If you want to, like...
So critical aortic stenosis is when the aortic valve was so stenosed or closed up that blood really wasn't leaving her body well. And they realized this when she was about 40 hours old, thank goodness, before we left the hospital. So blood wasn't really getting from her heart out into her body.
Okay. And your first open heart surgery, you were 4 weeks old?
Yeah. I was 4 weeks old.
And Dawn, you know, can I ask as a parent, you know, just, I mean,
so, yeah, it was just kind of crazy.
Yeah, it's just wild. I mean, and then look, I'm a parent. I haven't had to deal with that. And I don't want to be, you know, sort of maudlin or cliche. I just want you to tell me as much as you remember about that, just getting through that.
Okay, so she was like around 40 hours old, and we would have taken her home the next morning. Thank goodness now they do the pulse ox on all the new babies in New York State. We actually went to Syracuse because there wasn't an interventionalist at the time at the U of R, and they did a balloon at 40 hours old, and then came back, and Dr. Alfieris did the open heart surgery when she was 4 weeks old. Then she came home, and that really wasn't able to open up real well, so then she actually had another balloon at 3 months old, and then that worked really well until she was seven, when she had her other open heart surgery, which you can probably talk about.
Yeah. I fully remember everything from my open heart at 7 years old. That was the Ross procedure. And so actually they took the valve in the aortic position and literally like threw it out or whatever. And then they took the pulmonary valve, put it in the aortic position, and then they took a pig valve like from a pig and put it in the pulmonary position.
Once again, modern medicine's amazing.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's crazy. And by the way, after you're done with your descriptions here, the doctors are going to grade you on this. It's always interesting for a cardiologist to hear how their patients describe what's going on. I'm sure I get it wrong in my own conditions all the time.
Yeah.
So you're seven, and
right.
you remember everything about that.
Yeah, I remember everything.
Do you remember how you felt after? I mean, did you remember, you know, how you felt going into that? Was there a reason that you decided, or your family and your doctors decided at seven you needed that? What had changed?
I couldn't tell you exactly what changed.
Donna, did you remember?
Yeah.
So the pressures and the pressures across the aortic valve had gotten too high at that point.
But was it manifesting with her in different ways?
At seven, we didn't really see a lot of symptoms as a mom.
Okay.
But she's actually going to face her neck surgery soon, and she is having a few symptoms, so she might be able to talk about that.
Okay, but that was caught because was she doing regular
absolutely
checks?
Okay, regular checks. Her whole life.
So yeah, they find that, 7 years old, and it went pretty well. I mean, do you remember at seven how you felt afterwards?
Yeah. I mean, going into it, obviously, like, you're scared. You're like a seven-year-old kid. You're supposed to be running around and stuff. And
sure.
Like, you got to go into open heart. I'm like, oh, my God. But afterwards, I mean, it was a success and stuff. I spent a week in the hospital, and you go, like, room to room. You move around the hospital, you know. But, yeah, I mean, you don't know, like, how much muscle is actually, like, in your chest. Because you go to sit up, and it's like there's, like, an elephant sitting on your chest mm-hmm. when you first have that open heart because they cut open, like, the sternum or whatever it is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Okay, and no procedures since then, is that right?
Yeah, I had a catheterization a couple.
She had a balloon this past April. Okay. And again, they tried to open up that pulmonary valve.
Via catheter.
Via catheter, mm-hmm. yep, at Strong. And they did open it up, but not quite enough. But they created a little more leak, which is a problem. But there's still too much stenosis across that pulmonary valve, which is why they're going to go in now and replace it again.
And the next procedure for you, Maddie, is when?
We're not sure yet, but it's going to be probably before the end of my school year or into the summer, but we're not sure. So in a few months.
How are you feeling about it?
Obviously a little nervous, but, I mean, what can you do about that? So got to go in for it.
Do you sort of feel like you're getting to be an old pro at this stuff?
Yeah, definitely.
No, that's good. Yeah. That's good. It looks like you've got a great disposition. And do you also now feel that you understand what you have? And it helps knowing what it is, and it helps knowing that you've had this procedure. The medical teams in this area are amazing. I mean, mm-hmm. does that help your mindset?
Yeah, it definitely gives me hope for what they're going to do. And
And what about your activity schedule in school, outside of school? Is it impacted by this?
There's definitely restrictions at the beginning of my life kind of thing. For like 5 years after the second open heart surgery, I had many restrictions. So, you know, but the past like 2 years, I've kind of been free to do whatever. So that's kind of really nice.
And are you feeling a little differently lately?
Yeah. So some of my symptoms have been like chest pain and shortness of breath.
Mm-hmm. But, okay. Yeah. Well, they've done it before.
Right.
They're going to do it again. And good luck to you. How are you feeling, Dawn? How are you feeling about this?
Same thing. We're very hopeful. She's gone through this twice. We're lucky that the same surgeon is the plan to do this open heart surgery again. And as you said, the resources here in Rochester are wonderful. So, we have very strong faith that things will go very well.
Dr. Storozynski, how'd they do on their descriptions?
Very well.
It's no surprise. Patients really get to know their hearts and their conditions pretty well, don't they?
Absolutely.
What's your short definition of stenosis?
So basically, it's critical narrowing of the aortic valve. And as they mentioned, the aortic valve is the last valve out of the heart. And actually, what's interesting is that older patients, as we get older and older in our seventh and eighth decades of life, we often do develop aortic stenosis. And the difference is that in kids, it's probably something that she was obviously born with, but something that occurred as the heart is developing, where the valve leaflets are just fused and they're not really opening up. Whereas in adults, what happens is that the valves become calcified over time, and then the adults would go through either the balloon procedure like you're describing or open heart surgery if they're otherwise candidates for open heart surgery in order to improve their exercise tolerance, resolve their shortness of breath and their chest pain.
Dr. Malins, with a patient like Maddie, should she expect more procedures? I mean, I know that's not a fun subject, but she's tough. She's smiling back at us here. She knows the game. Should she expect more procedures as she goes throughout life? Is there, a general expectation?
Well, I think our hope is that this last surgery will be the last for her. We talked a little bit beforehand. Certainly, it will be followed throughout her life, and there may be catheterizations to check pressures and things like that. But, hopefully this last one will do it. And Maddie, we talked a little bit before. She's actually, I think it would be nice to hear her senior project, which she's going to have about this. And she's actually been a big help with us in the Heart Association. She spoke at last year's Heart Ball, and we set records at the Heart Ball with nearly 500,000. A lot of it is due to her story. We had big donations from Rob and Pamela Sands and the Wegmans as well, and we did I think third in the country, and a lot of it was thanks to her because her story is not only compelling, and she is such a good speaker and willing to talk about it and share with the community.
Yeah, that's got to make you feel good, Maddie. How does that hit you?
Yeah.
Awesome.
It's amazing experiences.
Well, great. And Dr. Malins, it's also important to ask more generally here. This is a case where, Dawn is saying by the time Maddie wasn't even 2 days old and they're understanding something's up here. Parents often have questions when they look at their own family histories. Maybe a mom and dad will say, well, look, my parents had heart disease or my grandparents did. I have to think about it for myself, but should my children be checked? How young do we need to start worrying about certain different kinds of tests and checks based on our own histories?
So hers is unique because it's a congenital heart condition, and so that should typically be picked up in the first days of life in the hospital, and it was done so with her. And then when we're talking about conditions that affect us as we get older, and we're talking about Jerry's condition, is, we're talking, at least before he had any problem, primary prevention, and that's what we're doing, is working with risk factors, the high blood pressure, the high cholesterol, realizing family history, diabetes, smoking, and really trying to prevent that first event. And now, as he can tell you, now that he's had an event, we're talking about what's secondary prevention, preventing the second event from occurring. And he's on a lot more medications now than he was. We're paying a lot more strict compliance to what his cholesterol numbers are, what his blood pressure numbers are, and getting him in a certified cardiac rehab. Certified cardiac rehab, and the data is very consistent, is people live longer who, after an event like that, complete a cardiac rehab course. And so with him, it's going to be making sure that his numbers are good, the blood pressure is good, and preventing a second event. And through the Heart Association and through a lot of our organizations and the research that we've done, and a lot of the research that we've gotten from the American Heart Association dollars, we're able to prevent that. And we know a lot more about how the heart works and how to keep it that way in many years to come.
Well, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, a third of victims die with the disease undiagnosed. And so what we're talking about are different definitions and terms and understanding, what we need to understand about our hearts. And we're going to turn it over to some of your questions in our second half hour. I've got them some via email. If you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll free, 844-295-8255. Or if you're calling from Rochester, it's 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You're hearing Dr. Tim Malins, Chief of Medicine at Geneva General Hospital and President of the New York Cardiological Society. Dr. Eugene Storozynski is here, Associate Professor of Cardiology at UR Medicine and Director of the Cardio-Oncology Clinic at URMC. You just heard the story from Maddie Hoadley. She is a congenital heart disease survivor, really remarkable 16-year-old who's a junior at Spencerport High School. Her mom, Dawn, is here, and Jerry Serafine, who is the owner of Restaurant Two Vines, sharing his story as well. We'll get to your questions via phone and email after this break. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, the Raise the Age campaign is picking up in New York State. When we're talking about raising the age, we're talking about the age of criminal responsibility as an adult. We're talking about the difference between trying a 16-year-old as a juvenile versus as an adult, and we'll explore that debate. In our second hour, getting better sleep, techniques, things that you can do to change how you feel every day. That's Wednesday. All right, welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I'm going to get to Bob's question via email with a little bit of background here. When you hear about a coronary calcium score test, it's not something a lot of people have heard too much about. And depending on where you read, you hear that every man over the age of 45, every woman over the age of 50 should have a coronary calcium test. Not sure that's true. We're going to find out in a second. I guess it uses CT scanning to measure the location and the amount of calcified plaque in the arteries. And here's Bob's question. He says, on a coronary calcium scan, is it good for those with a heart disease history in the family? My father would have been 73 years old today. Unfortunately, he died of a heart attack at age 46. My primary care physician seemed to discourage my suggestion that I might be a good candidate for one, though. And that's from Bob. So he's wondering, doctors, you want to grab this here? Dr. Storozynski?
So if someone doesn't have traditional risk factors for heart disease, a coronary calcium score might be a very good test to try to further delineate whether or not they truly are at risk for heart disease. But I would say the fact that his father died at the age of 46, at such a young age, unless he had diabetes, was a smoker, et cetera, that Bob is certainly at increased risk for heart disease. And really, what then you should really be doing is modifying those risk factors. And so I would say that the coronary calcium score is for those individuals who do not want to take appropriate steps in order to improve their overall health, meaning that they are averse to taking medications, cholesterol-lowering medicines, and aspirin a day, even though the doctor may be prescribing that because of their known risk factors. But if someone has those risk factors, I'm not sure that the coronary calcium score in of itself should be enough to say, okay, I should take those medications or not. And the reason I say that, if I may interrupt,
sure, absolutely,
just because, you know, in that statistics that you gave from the CDC, where a third of the patients die unknowingly of heart disease, what that speaks to is the fact that the majority of people that suffer an acute heart attack suffer a heart attack because they have a 20 or 30% blockage, not because they have the 95% blockage as Jerry experienced, the 70% blockage that the writer from the Washington Post had experienced, but the 20 or 30% blockage, which is what we call a vulnerable plaque. It's a soft covered plaque. And basically what happens is that there's some event that causes a tear in that plaque. And now suddenly the artery on the inside forms a scab. And it's that scab that prevents blood flow from getting beyond that blockage and causes the heart attack. And most calcium score tests do not pick up the vulnerable plaques. So if you have a lot of risk factors or a lot of concerning features for heart disease, those risk factors need to be addressed without necessarily getting the calcium score.
So I'm a little confused here then, doctor. What's the benefit of a coronary calcium score?
I mean, again, it's for those people that believe that they have no significant risks or they really don't have any significant risks, so they don't have a strong family history of heart disease, they're athletic, they do not have elevated cholesterol, they do not have diabetes, they're not overweight, they do not have high blood pressure, but yet there are some concerning symptoms that they might have of chest discomfort or shortness of breath that would require further evaluation. And in those individuals, it may be reasonable to get a coronary calcium score to see if they're at risk for heart attacks.
What does the actual score test entail?
Basically, you go through a CT scan.
Okay.
And the CT scan, which is radiation exposure, albeit at a very low dose, but the CT scan will pick up calcium deposition within the heart arteries. And so based on the amount of calcium that you have deposited throughout your heart arteries, that's how you come up with a calcium score.
We should not assume that every man over the age of 45, everyone over the age of 50 needs one or should get one then.
I would not assume that.
Okay. And you mentioned an aspirin a day as a possible idea that people hear. Some people wonder if that's a myth. Aspirin a day?
So I think in the right people, an aspirin a day is actually good. So there is, through the Heart Association, through the American College of Cardiology, there is a online cardiac risk calculator for heart disease. And basically what you plug in are your age, your blood pressure, whether or not you have diabetes, whether or not you have high blood pressure, are you on treatment, what your total cholesterol level is, what your good cholesterol level is, if you're a smoker or not. And based on filling in all those blanks, you come up with a percentage, a 10-year risk percentage of developing heart disease. So if your risk score or percent is greater than 7.5% in that 10-year, in the next 10 years, then certainly the recommendations would be to start a cholesterol-lowering medicine, and it would also be to start a aspirin a day. And typically a baby aspirin that's enteric-coated would be perfectly fine.
All right, let me grab a phone call. It's Patricia in Irondequoit. Go ahead, Patricia.
Hey, Evan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
In all this discussion of intervention related to heart disease, I've heard no mention of plant-based diets and the overwhelming evidence that shows that they can both reduce the risk of heart disease and even possibly reverse it. And so I'd like to have the doctors comment on their thoughts around diet as it relates to heart disease. Thank you.
Thanks, Patricia. Dr. Storozynski.
Sure, happy to. Thank you, Patricia, for the call. And certainly I do agree, and there's lots of data to suggest that a Mediterranean diet that is rich in fruits and nuts and oils and plants is very good, and certainly can reduce your cholesterol levels and reduce your risk of heart disease. But what I also want to stress to the general audience is that it's not unheard of for the vegan or the vegetarian to come in with symptoms that maybe shortness of breath or increasing fatigue, and they discount that as potentially being related to their heart, and in fact, they're found to have pretty advanced heart disease. So yes, every avenue of prevention, and that includes diet, exercise, is something that we should certainly pursue, but I don't want the general public to presume that just because you have a phenomenal diet, that in the absence of other risk factors, that you may not be prone to heart disease.
You know what's going to happen now, Doctor. The rest of the hour, we're going to be talking about plant-based diet.
And again,
I'm sure it comes up a lot.
Absolutely. And plant-based diet is a very good diet. And in fact, I have family members that are vegetarian and such. And so I think everything has to be put into perspective in moderation. And that's not to say that a plant-based diet is not a good diet for us, for individuals, but that is also not to say that individuals that decide to eat meat once in a while are necessarily at a significantly increased risk of heart disease compared to the other group.
Well, Evan, if I can throw in an anecdote here, I was eating an Italian sausage when I had my symptoms. And when I went,
what are you doing, Jerry? What is going on here?
When I went to the hospital, I relayed that. They said, "What exactly were you doing?" And little did I know that that would go into my medical record. And so every doctor along the way that I spoke with said, "How was the sausage?" And when I was actually getting the procedure, the technicians said, "You are eating a sausage. We want to know what kind."
This is the weirdest conversation.
So I said, I said the brand, and one guy said, "I got it." And he won the over and under on what kind of sausage. But the doctor also told me it's not that. It's not what you ate.
Jerry, on behalf of all the vegans listening, have you considered plant-based diet?
Mostly what I eat. That was an anomaly, eating
okay.
an Italian sausage.
And do you think it was a coincidence that...
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Things you don't expect to talk about. Let's get back to our phone call. Sam in Rochester. Go ahead, Sam.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I am 66, and I have been a diabetic ever since I was in my 30s. And I have been taking, first of all, I used to exercise a lot. I used to be a long-distance runner here in the city. And then I wore my knees out and can't exercise like I used to. But I take omega-3s. Now, I haven't heard you talk about the advantage of taking omega-3, which acts as a lubricant to the arteries and the vessels and the stuff that, and to keep them from stuff from clogging up in them and breaking apart. So I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
Sam, thank you. There's a new AHA report saying that people with heart failure could live longer by taking omega-3 fish oil supplements because they seem to reduce the risk, reduce the heart disease death rate by almost 10%. Again, that's out from this month from AHA, but I don't know how much the medical community is grabbing that and running with it, or are we still kind of on the fence about omega?
Omega-3 fatty acids are very important, and they're very good because they do raise your HDL, which is the good cholesterol. But I think one of the things that we need to keep in mind, and that's what I had alluded to about the 20 or 30% blockage, right? The fact that a lot of the coronary artery disease that we are seeing these days seems to be related to inflammation. And inflammation seems to be playing a very important role in the progression of heart disease. And so anything that we can do to reduce inflammation may help in turn reduce heart disease. So things like taking a cholesterol-lowering medicine, a statin, even though they are primarily used in order to lower the bad cholesterol, the LDL in your bloodstream, which we know independently is a risk factor for developing of coronary artery disease. We also know that statins also decrease your inflammatory markers in your bloodstream. And it seems that through some trials that there is an association between decreasing those inflammatory markers and naturally reducing the risk of subsequent heart attacks in patients. So omega-3s are excellent, and I certainly recommend taking them, but I would not take them in isolation, especially if you otherwise would benefit also from a cholesterol-lowering medicine like a statin because of its other properties.
He mentioned diabetes as well, and on the list of sort of regular myths about heart disease or treatment or symptoms or risk, is this one, you know, the idea that diabetes won't threaten my heart as long as I just take my medication. You know, would you say true or false there, Dr. Malins?
Absolutely false. Absolutely false. I mean, the taking your medication, you can get your blood glucose levels, which are elevated in diabetics, you can get it down. Now, just taking it and not paying attention to what the number is may not, may be continue to put you at risk. And I would say that the number one cause of death in diabetics overwhelmingly is cardiovascular disease. And it is very important to get a very good working relationship with you and either your endocrinologist or your primary care doctor to make sure that not only you're taking the medications, whether it be oral medications or you've advanced to insulin, but making sure that not only you know where your numbers need to be, but making sure that you're getting yourself there. And that's really where the working relationship between patient and physician is imperative. And it's true as with cholesterol numbers, blood pressure numbers, quitting smoking, all of those types of things.
Doctor?
And if I could just add that, as Dr. Malins had suggested, diabetes is a disease of all of the blood vessels. So not only can it affect the heart, it can cause a stroke, it can cause kidney disease and result in people being on dialysis. So unfortunately, or the importance of not only knowing your diabetes, but treating it well is to prevent all of these other blood vessel related problems down the line.
All right, before I get back to your phone calls, I want Maddie to remind us, we had heard about your senior project, and there's a story to tell here. You're a junior now, right?
Yeah, I'm a junior.
So you're thinking about your senior project for next year at Spencerport?
Yeah.
And it's going to be what?
So I'm actually going to do early decision so I can start my senior project as a junior. So my open heart surgery is coming up, and I'm like, well, I might as well do something with that. So I'm going to record or, like, take parts of from the night before the surgery all the way through until, like, the month after in recovering and kind of just show, like, what is the reality of having open heart surgery and like the recovery and, you know, so yeah, I just want to kind of like make a video of that and kind of spread the word of.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Don, how do you feel about that?
I'm very proud of Maddie and her efforts in sharing. She's very comfortable sharing her story. She did it at the American Heart Ball last spring, and now she's trying to put together almost a video book or, you know, a resource for other people, and it's probably especially kids that are going through open heart surgeries, just kind of to give them an inside look. She's very optimistic, so she'll put that positive spin and that hope on it. So I'm very proud of her in sharing this, her story with us.
Maddie, I am very impressed. I mean, you speak really, really comfortably about this, and I know it. For many people, it's not easy. It's not always a comfort level. I remember when I was your age and I went in for a non-open heart surgery, a catheter ablation. I remember, you know, I had a lot of nerves about it because I'm not a doctor and I'm 17 years old. Mm-hmm. And they do this. And I remember waking up thinking, I can't, you know, I remember going into it thinking, am I going to be able to talk about it? No, don't joke about it. This is serious. I wake up and my friend had come to visit and I had been passed out the whole time. And he left me a card that said, well, you didn't die. You owe me $5 for parking. And I realized I can laugh about this. It'll be all right. But not everybody wants to laugh or talk about it. Why are you so comfortable?
I think that if you don't talk about it, then no one knows and no one can help out. And you need to raise awareness, tell like, hey, this is what's going on. You know?
It's awesome. It's really impressive stuff. Let me get back to the phones, and Anne in Penfield is next. Go ahead, Anne.
Oh, thank you. It's a wonderful show. I have a somewhat two-part question about diagnostics when your patient arrives or is on the way to the hospital. On the first part, I'm wondering, do the specialized cardiac response teams from the ambulance companies, do they sort of triage a patient for you? By intercepting an ambulance on the way, if you could talk about that. And then I was also curious, Jerry mentioned that the EKG was perfectly normal. So my question is, do other types of tests, like a lipid profile, does that give you anything, or do you actually have to start doing exploratory? So thank you, and I'm glad you're doing your show. It's wonderful.
Thank you, Ann. Doctors, want to jump in? Go ahead, Dr. Malins.
Yeah, so that's a very good question. It's a segue into something that we're actually going to be doing here in the Rochester area and the greater Rochester area. It's something sponsored through the American Heart Association, and it's called Mission Lifeline. And this is a project that we are in the midst of right now. And what it is it's going to streamline the process for people with acute heart attacks. And not only is it very important to do it here throughout the greater Rochester area, where we have all of the hospitals that are able to do the diagnostics and treatments available, but also some of the more rural communities. Because as we were talking about with Jerry earlier, time is of the essence. Time is heart muscle. And the quicker you can get somebody to a facility, whether it be Strong, whether it be RGH or Unity locally, and open up that artery, the better the outcomes are. And we're going to be embarking on this to not only streamline these times in the Rochester area, but also the greater Rochester area. And we've done this in other markets and really see significant improvements in outcomes. The second part of your question, as far as why Jerry did not have EKG changes, was probably because his artery was not 100% blocked. There was some residual flow that was going through it, and that can happen. And that's why he didn't need to go emergently. He was monitored, and then the next day went in, found that major blockage, and subsequently opened up the artery.
Jerry, your blockage was what percent, by the way, again? It was 95%?
95%.
95%. Dr.
But it was a very small artery, just a mm-hmm. branch. So. Mm-hmm.
The blood test that ultimately determined if Jerry should go over for his catheterization was the troponin level, and that's a blood protein that is only released in the bloodstream if there has been any potential damage to the heart muscle, because it's normally only present within heart muscle cells. So as I understand it, you had a serial blood test, and it was the second or third blood test after about 6 or 7 hours after your presentation with the chest pain that ultimately suggested there was a little bit of positivity.
Even the first blood test normally, I was told, comes back negative. So you really have to have, like, every 6 hours. And it was the second blood test in the middle of the night that showed that there was definitely an event.
And so based on that event, he was subsequently taken for further testing. In the absence of that, meaning in someone that has no EKG changes, no electrical mm-hmm. rhythm abnormalities, negative blood tests, there are other tests, what are called stress tests, that can be done for patients that are considered to be at relatively low risk for heart disease. So Jerry would have been one of those individuals if his blood test did not come back positive. They likely would have had him do an echocardiogram in which he exercised, or what we call a nuclear exam. And so you get images at rest and then with activity. And the expectation is that with activity, the heart muscle gets stronger with activity. And you could see whether or not there is a wall motion abnormality where the blockage may be if there is a blockage with stress. And that in of itself would then cause the doctors to send him for that catheterization procedure.
Katie on Twitter tells us she's 30 years old. She had a heart attack last May. Her symptoms were she was flu-like, she was vomiting, feverish, etc. So about 40 seconds here. But Katie's story on Twitter is a perfect example of this idea that people think it has to be chest pain. That's going to be the thing. And she's saying flu-like, feverish, vomiting, then discovered she was having a heart attack. Dr. Malins?
Yeah, possible. It's hard to determine exactly what type of heart attack she had. She certainly could have had a viral inflammation of the heart, which can release these enzymes. It would be very atypical for someone her age unless there was a lot of risk factors.
She tore an artery while working out. No heart disease. Wow. Wow. Katie, I'm glad you're okay. I think you're okay. Wow. What an amazing story. But I guess we've learned this hour. There's a lot more than just a small category of heart challenges. And I just want to thank our guests. Jerry, I'll see you at Tuvine. Any spicy sausage on the Tuvine menu?
No, we've got a great vegan burger, though. Get me out of trouble here.
Jerry, we joke because you're okay. It's great to see you. Thank you. And Maddie, good luck to you. I'm really impressed with you. I know you're in good hands, and all the best going forward.
Thank you.
Dawn, thank you as well. All the best to your family.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Malins, great talking to you, and thanks for all the great work that you do. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Evan.
And Dr. Storzinski, same. Learned a lot from you, and thanks for the work that you do.
My pleasure. Thank you, Evan.
Rob Braden's the engineer, Megan Max the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Stay safe out there. Have a nice afternoon, and we'll talk to you Wednesday on Member Supported Public Radio.